Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thanks for tuning in. Do you remember how earlier in a previous episode, we had said we would maybe do more ghost or monster spooky stories leading into Halloween?
Well, yes. Yes, I do remember that, Ben. We're a little early for Halloween, but you know what? We're so chock full of monsters that we just got them spilling out of the sides. So we're going to start early with a story about something called the Aswang.
The Aswang, yes.
Oh, excuse me.
You're right.
I'm sorry.
You're right. I think either way, you are correct. We were talking about a very specific type of monster. And before we get to it, let's introduce one of our favorite monsters, ladies and gentlemen, super producer Casey Pegram. Casey, are you okay that I referred to you as a monster? Is that?
Love it.
Casey on the case. So growing up, were you into monsters, Noel?
I mean, I'm clearly a monster myself because I'm eating Cheez-Its on this show. Unacceptable behavior. Boorish. Ugh. Gosh, I hate myself. No, of course I loved monsters. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was a little frightened of them. I thought they lived under my bed and in my closet.
Sure.
Do you remember that movie, The Willies?
Barely. Wow, that's a deep cut.
It's a deep cut. It has young Sean Astin in it, uh-huh. And it's sort of an Are You Afraid of the Dark style campfire tale movie where it's like an anthology. Yeah. And there was one in particular where there was a really creepy, gangly kind of pumpkin head looking monster with long, skinny fingers who menaced the children at a middle school. And that stuck with me, Ben.
Mm. Yeah, it's strange when you think of how profoundly some of those things can impact us as children. I was addicted to scary stories to tell in the dark.
Those covers alone are like nightmare fuel, pure nightmare fuel.
And the guy's a legit folklorist. And one of the things I loved about it was that it was different from the usual fare of monstrosity that we see in the U.S. I've also wondered, I don't know how much digging you've done in this, but I've also wondered and marveled at the sheer variety of goblins, ghouls, witches, and monsters in other parts of the world. Like just what we would categorize as vampires, just that category alone, contains hundreds and hundreds of creatures that many people have never heard of. But in their countries of origin, these creatures are taken very, very seriously, and one of them is the Aswang.
Yeah, well, the Aswang is sort of a pantheon of monsters, right? Mm-hmm. It's sort of like in Japanese culture, you've got the yokai, which are just kind of a stand-in for any kind of goblin or magical creature or whatever. And here's the thing. I wanted to pose this to you before we get too much further.
Sure.
We're talking about our childhood obsession and fear and PTSD associated with monsters. But as a 35-year-old man, and Ben, I'm not gonna spill your age. You're ageless. But I don't think monsters are real anymore. That is not something that keeps me up at night. It's just normal baseline anxiety that keeps me up at night now. That's my monster.
Yeah.
But in other countries. Mm-hmm. That's not quite the case.
That's absolutely true. Hey, can I have some Cheez-Its?
Yeah,
do you have any leftover?
Yeah, here you go.
Thanks. Can you guys tell we're recording on a Friday afternoon?
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, man. So, yeah, that's absolutely true. These are taken seriously, and the Aswang is just one example. You'll hear other names for it, too, like the Tick-Tick or the Kling-Kling or the Aswang. But I think you're right. Our fears tend to evolve with us. You know what I mean? Our monsters grow up with us. That sounds way more cryptic than I intended. And in the Philippines, where the Aswang originates, they have often been taken very seriously as like a legitimate, credible physical threat to you and your loved ones.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you probably, if you grew up in the Philippines, it's tasty, isn't it, Ben?
Mm-hmm.
Got a good crunch. Good.
I'm trying to do it off the mic.
Good bite. Yeah, that's probably good etiquette. But yeah, I mean, you know, if you grew up in the Philippines or you know somebody that grew up in the Philippines, chances are you've met somebody that, whether they themselves or someone they know or possibly their grandpa or something or, you know, a loved one, will have claimed with full belief to have either encountered one of these creatures, possibly been attacked by one of them, or even maybe know someone who met their untimely end at the hands or claws or fangs or,
Dripping intestines.
Dripping intestines. Yeah, can we go through some of the—
Let's do some of these.
I think we should before we get into the setup.
Yeah. Okay, so as we mentioned, Aswang is kind of an umbrella term. And in different regions of the Philippines, you will hear different descriptions of what an Aswang actually is. And despite its different variations, it is probably the most frightening mythical creature in this type of folklore. So one thing that's always kind of the common thread is that they're shapeshifters. They can somehow change shape. The big differences arrive when we ask what shapes they change into. So we mentioned that they can have long claws. Did we mention the torso thing yet?
You alluded to it, Ben, but give us the quick and dirty.
So there's the appearance of a person that's just a torso, arms and a head, and they're flying, they levitate, and their intestines drip down under them.
Just kind of dragging like a like a train, you know?
And they eat unborn children and toddlers. Usually they want to eat the livers and the hearts.
Yeah, and there's even one that I think has some sort of specially adapted tongue that they can use to suck out the fetus from a pregnant woman.
Yeah, like a very evil mosquito.
Exactly.
Yeah, so they're sometimes described as very, very thin. They're always described as kind of fast. And some of them make different noises, right? That's going to be important later.
Yeah, that's right. There's some that look like pigs who make obviously pig-type noises, snorting and, you know, grinding their teeth. And they're also quite large. Then they're also like werewolf-type Aswang that are, you know, about like you would think. Some of them look more like a regular dog. Some of them look like maybe like a hyena or a jackal or something like that, or just some kind of any kind of like wild kind of rabid beast. But then you have the scariest of all, that there's a great connection between this and the way we look at these kind of creatures, vampires. You've got the ones that look mainly like you or I.
Mm-hmm. But they are still out for blood, livers, and hearts, right? Because they can shift into a human form and then shift, I guess, into their more monstrous form. Is that correct?
As legend would have it.
As legend would have it, yes. Very important. Very important. They also have these techniques that are so fascinating. For instance, if you read on mythology.net, just a quick overview of Aswang there, it's apparently common for Aswang to turn plants into doppelgangers of their victims to hide evidence of their hunting from locals.
That's pretty cool, Ben.
I mean, it's a dark power, but it's a pretty neat power, right? And so they do it in two ways. They might make a doppelganger of a corpse, so it looks like the person died without an Aswang attack, or they might make a doppelganger of a living person. When they make one of a living person, a living victim, then the doppelganger goes to that person's home, they fall ill, and they die. Why are we telling you all of this? Well, we're telling you this because this story comes into play in a very strange and ingenious way shortly after World War II. The Philippine Army is fighting an insurgency led by communist rebels known as the Hukbalahap. And pardon my pronunciation, I am not a Tagalog speaker.
Well, you're not going to try the alternate pronunciation for when they sort of shifted their purposes? That one's even harder. It's got like an NG on its own there. How do you pronounce that? NG on its own.
So this army is having the age-old series of problems that organized armies have when they run into guerrilla forces, right? They're fighting an enemy that is often invisible, able to blend in with the local non-fighting population. You know what I mean? And they're like, how do we combat this? We need a method of our own. We need something we could do that will squash this rebellion, and it may need to be an unconventional method. Because this also, just for the background here, these guys, who are also called Hucks, H-U-K, they're fighting against the status quo, the wealthy Filipinos who had collaborated with Japanese invaders.
Right, because originally they were part of the team, right? Mm-hmm. During World War II, when the Philippines were leagued up with the U.S. fighting against the Japanese, this group was fighting the good fight, right?
Right.
And then after the end of the war, they kind of became installed as the de facto militia or military of the communist government, right?
Right, because you can see how they feel very shortchanged in this at this position, because the collaborators with the Japanese have grabbed a ton of land afterwards, and they own a bunch of resources, and the inequality of the country, which was already very extreme, is just going to continue as though nothing has changed. So of course they want a rebellion. Of course they want a different government.
And just to try my hand at butchering your pronunciation, they did change the name after this switcheroo happened to Hukbo Ngbayan Laban Sahapon.
That was pretty
good.
Also
known as the anti-Japanese army.
That was pretty good, man. I thought that was pretty good.
But not only were they against the Japanese army, they ultimately ended up becoming against the Filipino government because they believed that the president, Manuel Roxas, was a sympathizer with or a collaborator, I guess, with what, the Japanese? I'm confused about that.
Yeah, that he was collaborating with them to enrich himself.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, you know, is capitalism. So that's obviously not going to fly with these guys. But there's another player enters the game.
Yeah, the big one, because lest we forget, the U.S. is involved and has an interest here, and they want to get those Hukbos literally running for the hills. So enter Air Force Brigadier General Edward G. I read this originally, and I thought it said Landslide, which would have been an awesome last name for a general, but unfortunately it is Lansdale. And he is a huge proponent of a little something called PSYOPs. Ben, bless us with your military history acumen. What's PSYOPs?
Like everybody knows, psychological operations, also known as psychological warfare. This includes everything from propaganda given to soldiers over the radio to things like ghost armies that we've mentioned before.
Yeah, like in Vietnam, the U.S. military used the sounds, recorded sounds of like wailing, damned ancestors of the Viet Cong, and it works. So I would say PSYOPs is sort of the art of freaking out your enemy.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a good way to describe it. It's intimidation. And Lansdale is very, very familiar with this. There's a great book by an author named Max Boot called The Road Not Taken, Edward Lansdale and the American Tragedy in Vietnam, which touches on some of Lansdale's activities. Lansdale is no stranger to PSYOPs. He's a huge fan of psychological warfare. And he has chops. He has some things on his resume that are unethical but impressive. He orchestrates a campaign in Vietnam that makes nearly a million refugees flee the country because he hired a soothsayer to predict good fortune for South Vietnam and bad luck for the North.
Wow, okay.
So not firing a shot. Just getting into people's heads.
Yeah, yeah. You know what it reminds me of? There's an episode of Monty Python where it's like the most dangerous joke in the world, and they use it against their enemies, and only every major commander can only hold like one word of the joke at a time, because if they themselves read it in one go, they would be stricken mad or whatever.
Yeah.
So they hold it up for the enemy to see. You see it take some kind of a minute to recognize what it is, and then they all just laugh themselves to death. You know, obviously kind of a silly satirical version, but sort of describing this phenomenon that we're talking about here, using people's thoughts and attitudes and preconceived ideas against them.
Yes, and we have a quote from Lansdale himself at something called the AswangProject.com, Psy War in the Philippines, Aswang and the CIA. So this is before his Vietnam stuff, by the way. So Lansdale says, a combat Psy War squad was brought in to the Philippines. It planted stories among town residents of an Aswang living on the hills where the Huks were based. So they spread these rumors. And then two nights later, after giving the stories time to sort of percolate up to the Huks, the ambushers silently snatched the last man of a patrol and they killed him. They punctured his neck with two holes, as if a vampire bit him, and they hung his body up by the heels to exsanguinate him, to drain him of all blood, and then they took the corpse, and they dragged it back to the trail where the guy would have disappeared, and they just plopped his body out there. So what happened next?
Well, they like littered these corpses, you know, all around the area, and it did not go over well with the invading forces, right? Or the, you know, attempting to overthrow forces.
Right, right. The communist rebel groups, they returned. They were trying to look for their comrade. And can you imagine how frightening that is? Like, that's the thing. It may sound silly for people to be frightened of a mythological monster, right? But imagine you work with someone, like think of all your coworkers, you work with someone, you go out to a party with them, they disappear, you come back the next day and you find them with bite marks and no blood. That's frightening. I might fall for that. I don't know. What do you think, Noel?
I mean, you know, tensions are already running high in this, you know,
true.
In this situation, this like guerrilla warfare. Here's the kicker though. This was PSYOPs on the surface, but PSYOPs typically doesn't involve war crimes because you're not supposed to, you know, they're capturing these people and then they're basically torturing and murdering them.
Yeah.
You know, they're not like putting them in POW camps. They are using their flesh and blood as some kind of crazy horror show to freak out their comrades.
And that brings us to an interesting question here because, you know, it's this event is not something that happened across the Philippines for, you know, years and years. It was this single operation, but they may not have been actually scared of Naswang at all. They may have just been scared of getting kidnapped and used as, you know, psychological torture for their compatriots. And a Huck squadron at this time was about 100 to 300 soldiers. And we don't know whether they were actually scared of a fictional creature or whether they were scared of the very real and very ruthless, as you mentioned, CIA, right?
Yeah, he had another trick that he liked to use, Lansdale, called the Eye of God. And this is much similar to the ghost tape kind of stuff we will hear about in Vietnam, where they basically, I don't know if they used a spooky voice over the loudspeakers, but they were like calling out the names of prominent Huck, you know, the commanders and threatening them with certain death. And, you know, I mean, can't you picture it being kind of Scooby-Dooed out like that?
Oh, get to the best part, though.
Oh, yeah. So adding insult to injury, they would also creep into their camp and paint these spooky eyes on the tent or wherever the people were sleeping. The house, I guess they had little huts. This is like they were in their villages, I guess.
For some reason, that seems even creepier to me, even creepier than hearing a weird noise, waking up and finding this non-consensual artwork. You know what I mean?
This didn't, like, you know, clear the Hucks out overnight or anything. I mean, it, you know, took about 4 years before Louis Taruk, who had been the leader of this organization for quite some time, actually surrendered and accepted a prison sentence. So, you know, I mean, it's really interesting to read about this stuff, and it's certainly a fascinating type of warfare. That author you mentioned earlier, Max Boot, the historian, says that this tactic was actually considered a war crime because they were killing these Filipino soldiers deliberately instead of, you know, capturing them as enemy combatants. And then, of course, they were mutilating their corpses too. So not a good look, but I guess effective? I don't know. What do you think, Ben?
Yeah, I mean, definitely not a good look, but certainly effective. And the CIA, so we clarify here, the CIA is telling the Filipino soldiers in the army to attack the communist rebels and use these tactics. And they do work. I mean, by the 50s, I think, as we mentioned, the Hucks are in serious decline. And Lansdale will go on to do more of this sort of stuff, especially in Vietnam, as we mentioned before. The type of techniques he applied were also sometimes called black combat. He also did another PSYOP we should mention. He would have different messages broadcast. Noel, you had mentioned earlier the messages warning rebel leaders and so on, but they would also fly planes very low overhead and broadcast messages to make the rebels believe spies were in their midst and they couldn't trust one another. So eventually in 1954, the rebels surrender and there's no argument about it. These tactics were very useful to Lansdale and to the Army of the Philippines. The question that we have to ask ourselves is, at what price victory? You know what I mean? It's not right to desecrate corpses.
No, it's definitely not. And, you know, I think our boy Lansdale would go on to use slightly less brutal techniques later in his career. But I guess this was just kind of a different time.
He's also, for anybody who wants a little bit of a lost treasure story, he also shows up in the old legend of Yamashita's gold, which is this hoard of treasure that was stolen by the Japanese forces during World War II and hidden somewhere in the Philippines. And according to the story, it's still there, and you can go search for it yourself, as many other treasure hunters have tried over the past few decades. We should mention the existence of this treasure is largely not taken seriously by a lot of experts, but of course, who doesn't want to find it? You can read more about that by checking out work of the author Sterling Seagrave, who claims the gold was secretly seized by the U.S. government after the location was discovered by interrogating and torturing Yamashita's driver, a Major Kojima Kashi. And then, here's where Lansdale comes in. Apparently, he supervised the torture.
Fun.
Allegedly.
Yeah, okay. Well, he's a hardened mofo, that's for sure. I mean, if he's hanging up dudes by their toes and stabbing them in the side of the neck and draining their blood for the purposes of spooking some enemy combatants, then this guy could probably do just about anything.
How many, folkloric beliefs or mythological monsters do you think people honestly believe in 2018? Because I've heard in Iceland that people still believe in fairies or gnomes.
Sure. Trolls, maybe?
Yeah, maybe trolls.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know, man. Like, I want to believe.
You're very molder about that, huh?
Yeah, no, I'm just moldy and sad and beaten down by life, Ben. But no, man, I don't know. Who are we to say?
Who are we to say? That's a good question. And you know what that makes me think of? You know the people who are to say? Boy, that was awkward. Let's do some listener mail.
Let's do it. Well, Dominic Allen has this to say. Hello, gents. Just listened to your episode on the naming of California, and you asked us to tell you if we ever have seen a griffin. I have seen part of one.
What?
Or rather, own part of one. Maybe. This ties in beautifully with today's episode, too. We just asked a question. What mythological creatures do you believe in? Dominic says he owns one. I shouldn't dilly-dally and explain myself. In the 1300s, there was a man called John Manville, or was there, who wrote a book called The Travels of Sir John Manville. Or did he? In this travel book, he visits Asia and talks about the weird and wonderful people and creatures that live there, one of them being a griffin. This is also one of the more boring creatures he talks about. He states that griffins are from a country called Bacaria and had talons so long, this is a quote here, quote, so long and so large and great upon his feet as though they were horns of great oxen or of bugles or of kine, so that men make cups of them to drink of. So what I meant was I have a drinking horn, which is made from the supposed claw of a griffin. I interjected with that supposed. At least that's what I tell people. I'm part of a 14th century living history group in England, and it is a great conversation piece as drinking horns weren't as popular in that time, but a griffin claw is a fascinating thing. The Travels of Sir John Manville could be a good podcast topic. I agree. The people in the book are pretty ridiculous. Thanks for the podcast. Look forward to more as they come. Always be ridiculous.
Not going to be a problem, Dominic.
No. We literally are contractually obligated to keep doing this show.
Yeah, like we get in trouble if we don't.
Yep.
But also, that's so amazing. This really inspires me to ask more questions on the show. Dominic, thank you. Also, bonus points if you can send us a picture, man.
Oh, yeah, we'd love that.
And I assume that you're not doing the 14th century living history thing all the time just because you did send us an email. This arrived via email, not via pigeon or parchment or a pigeon carrying parchment. But that's awesome. I would love to see a picture of this drinking horn, and I'm completely on board with the travels of Sir Manville. Our next listener mail is one that I think both of us are really going to dig. It is from Darren T., and it's titled Hangus the Monkey. Hi, says Darren. I listened from the start, but it's my first time writing. I've just heard your recent podcast on the Hartlepool monkey. I live in Thornaby on Tees, 10 miles up the road from Hartlepool. Hartlepool, he notes, is Teesside, not Tyneside. And he goes on to say, I was taught about this as a lesson on propaganda and racism in primary school, showing how people with nothing to go on but propaganda about how all Frenchmen are short, wild, and hairy can lead to this stuff. Whether this is a true story or not, it works as a great teaching tool. Although I personally don't believe it is true, I think it was just an excuse for a mocking nickname for people from the area. Here's the part you'll like, Noel. Like Mackems, which are people from Sunderland, and Smoggies, which are people from Middlesbrough. But it's a bit of fun. Thanks for the hours of entertainment, Darren. P.S. You pronounced all the Tyneside towns and cities correctly. Thank you. Casey, can we get a hallelujah clip? Perfect. So I got to say, Darren, thank you for writing. I am loving these very specific derogatory nicknames. Mackems, Smoggies. Does every town in England have one of these? We don't have anything like that for Atlanta. I guess people just say redneck, right?
This is true.
Well, maybe if you're listening, you can suggest a cool mocking nickname for people from Atlanta.
I will say this about that episode. I do think we kind of glossed over the fact that this was an interesting teachable moment about racism and othering, and this idea that this monkey supposedly was, you know, immediately identified as being a Frenchman, and that was how Frenchmen were depicted in these political cartoons of the time. So, you know, I think there's a something to be said about that. And I don't know if we mentioned this in the episode either, but there is actually a play about the Hartlepool monkey.
I thought we did.
I think maybe we did, but if we didn't describe it, it's so cool to look at because it's this really amazing puppetry. I don't know if you're familiar with the play War Horse. That's got this amazing, like, multi-layered puppetry sculpture kind of stuff. And that's what the Hartlepool monkey play is about. And it does kind of take a little liberty and talk more about that, like the way we treat immigrants and things like that. So there's kind of a twofold story there.
And thank you again to Dominic and Darren for writing in. Thank you, fellow Ridiculous Historians, for giving us a listen today. While we're thanking people, let's go ahead and thank our super producer, Casey Pegram.
Thanks also to our research associate, Eves Jeffscoat, who helped us out with this one. And also Christopher Hasiotis, who continues to be a mensch, and we love him dearly. And I think we might actually have him on. We might have him on for an episode one of these days soon.
Yeah, he's coming back.
It's due.
We're overdue.
Overdue. Thanks to Alex Williams, who composed our theme.
Mm-hmm. And thanks to Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. The Quizster, for not showing up on this episode.
I have a feeling we haven't seen the last of him.
I hear that laugh in the distance, and I don't think it's Casey piping it through the headphones.
It haunts me at night, Ben.
Yes. And speaking of haunting, we want to hear some of your favorite ridiculous historical events involving the supernatural or allegations thereof. You can tell us about these on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And we particularly like to give a shout out to our Ridiculous Historians Facebook page. It's one of the classiest joints on the internet.
Yeah, and one last little plug. Ben and I recently appeared on a 3-part episode of Behind the Bastards, which is a really, really amazing show out of our LA wing, hosted by Robert Evans, who is just a crackerjack writer and researcher. And he was kind enough / sadistic enough to have you and I on for a 4-hour podcast marathon about the infamous Alex Jones.
Yeah, it's a great listen. Robert's a great guy. It is not for children.
No.
There is strong language.
Yeah, if you want to hear me and Ben effing and jeffing, that's the place to do it.
And mature themes. But that was a good shout. Yeah. And follow Behind the Bastards. If you like us, you're going to really dig that show.
It's true. All 3 parts of that trifecta are out now.
Oh, it's a lot. It's a real commitment. It's a road trip. But yeah, that's it, man. Let's try to continue our habit of not desecrating corpses to win wars.
Yeah, and not digging up Pope corpses to make points. I don't know.
All right, well,
Happy Halloween, y'all.
Yeah.
It's Halloween all year.
Send us Jesus.